Good morning, welcome. Welcome to evidence, using evidence to inform public health practice. This is sponsored by the Public Health Nursing Session. My name is Bernadette Longo, and I'm from the University of Nevada, Reno. I have no relationships to this club. How is everyone this morning? How many of you walked here this morning? It's a fresh air, wonderful. So, in a healthy city of Philadelphia where so many people walk. Well, welcome to an exciting conference. We have some wonderful speakers who are going to share and show us all how public health nurses are using evidence. Our first speaker is Jennifer Huang. Jennifer is a research scientist for George Washington University's School of Public Health and Health Services, Department of Health Policy. She has worked on projects focused on improving quality of care and reducing disparities for diverse populations, including a national hospital collaborative to improve the delivery of language services. Before joining George Washington, Jennifer was project manager for the National Association of Public Hospitals and Health Systems, where she worked on a variety of research projects, including a survey of hospitals' financial operations and a study that examined patient-reported barriers to prenatal care. Her talk this morning, to start us off, is Reducing Disparities: Bilingual Nurses Caring for Patients with Limited English Proficiency. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Good morning.
First, I would like to mention that this study was supported by the California Endowment. And also, I wanted to acknowledge my co-authors on this paper, Crystal Bramlin, Mary Jones, and Mark Reckenstein. So, to give you an overview of the study, we wanted to learn about hospital policies and practices, about how they're using bilingual nurses and doctors, bilingual staff, and language services to care for patients with language needs. Part of the interest came from a prior survey that the California Endowment funded in 2006. And what they found were that bilingual clinicians are the most frequently used language resources after interpreters in hospitals. So for this study, we have two main data sources, a hospital survey and interviews. For the hospital survey, we conducted a telephone survey with 899 human resources directors of acute care hospitals in the U.S. We were particularly interested in California and rural hospitals, so we oversampled California hospitals with a final sample of 159, and we had a final sample of 560 rural hospitals. Because this is not what the hospital industry in the United States looks like, we weighted by governance, teaching status, market, and whether or not they were in California or not in California. And we weighted it to look at close to the actual distribution of hospitals in the United States. For the case studies, we interviewed provider associations and hospitals. For the provider associations, we spoke with nursing and medical associations, including the Hispanic Nursing Association and Chinese Medical Society. And for the hospitals, we selected hospitals to follow up with based on their survey responses about whether or not they assessed their bilingual clinicians for language proficiency. Some of the areas we were interested in finding out more information about were whether or not hospitals provide training for their staff on how to access language services, and furthermore, whether or not we have different requirements for different hospital staff. We also wanted to learn more about whether or not hospitals collect information on the language skills of doctors and nurses. We also wanted to know whether or not hospitals provide language proficiency assessments for their bilingual doctors and nurses. And finally, we wanted to learn more about whether they're using incentive programs for bilingual skills. So I'm going to run through the survey findings quickly. we asked hospitals about whether or not they care for patients whose primary language is not English. And you can see from this chart that the majority of hospitals we spoke with do provide care for patients whose primary language is not English. And of those hospitals, about 75% provide care to patients whose primary language is not English on a daily or weekly basis. So pretty frequently, they're seeing patients who have language needs. We also wanted to learn more about the type of resources that hospitals have to communicate with patients whose primary language is not English. 9 of the 10 hospitals reported having bilingual doctors or nurses. 1/3 say that they hire interpreters, and over half, around half, use volunteer interpreters. We also asked several questions in the survey about whether or not hospitals require certain, have certain qualifications for the staff they use to provide interpreter services. And what we found were that hospitals generally, with regards to experience as an interpreter, assessing their language proficiency, and training in medical interpreting, they have fewer requirements for their volunteer interpreters than for their staff interpreters. So I don't know if you can see, but the blue bar are the staff interpreters, and the red bar are the volunteer interpreters. So it's a little bit, it's a note of caution for hospitals because they're using volunteer interpreters more, and yet they're requiring much less in terms of, less than half of the hospitals are requiring their interpreters to have a language assessment. And even fewer, about a quarter, are requiring their volunteer interpreters to either have experience as an interpreter or require training in medical interpreting methodologies. Another area we wanted to find out about were whether or not hospitals are requiring their hospital staff to be trained in when to call an interpreter and how to actually access those interpreter services. And the majority of hospitals do require this type of training for their staff, although we did think it was notable that more than a quarter do not require this type of training for any of their hospital staff. Of the ones that, the little chart you see here, the big bars, the first two bars that you see are registration staff and nurses. So you can see here that it's over 95% of hospitals are requiring their nurses to take this type of training. And the smaller bars, you can see half of the doctors are required to take this type of training, and less than a third of their medical residents, less than a third of the hospitals are requiring their medical residents to take this type of training. And this supports a lot of what we heard from hospitals, and that nurses are frequently the decision point for whether or not patients are going to be getting interpreter services. Another area we wanted to know about were whether or not hospitals collect information for nurses and doctors about what languages they speak. So what you see here is that more hospitals are collecting this information for nurses than for doctors, with 50% of hospitals collecting languages for nurses and about half collecting this information for doctors. One of the areas we were particularly interested in, because we know that from talking to some hospitals from other projects, is something that is a challenge for hospitals, whether or not they're providing language proficiency assessment for bilingual doctors and nurses. And look, we weren't surprised to see that 18% of hospitals are providing these type of assessments for bilingual doctors and nurses, and only half of these hospitals require these for bilingual doctors and nurses. Of the hospitals, the 18% that do have an assessment, most of them do not provide a number for how many have been assessed, so they really are not tracking this information in terms of, well, even if they've been assessed, how many have been assessed. And of the 50 out of the ones that could provide a number, the number range from 0 to 100. So really, this information is not being tracked by hospitals, and it's an area that's not really well known for the hospitals. One thing to note about the language assessments, we did not address whether or not their assessments were actually good assessments. So from the hospitals we talked to, a lot of these were homegrown assessments. And there was, part of it is that they may have a sense that the next slide I'll show you, but so this is not getting at whether or not those assessments are good at all, even though there are instruments out there for assessment. So in a lot of cases, even the hospitals that are assessing, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're assessing them in a way that would be, in a way that really assesses their language proficiency and speaking with did not offer a language assessment for their bilingual doctors and nurses. We tried to find out what were the main reasons that they didn't offer one, and the top reason was that the assessments are not a priority for them, and that was about half of the hospitals were saying that's not a priority, and about a third were saying that there's no good tool for assessment. So there are a couple of tools out there, but it's not very widespread in terms of, it seems like not a lot of the hospitals know that there are some tools out there for language assessment. Of course, there's also cost involved, but that was also one of the reasons. About a quarter saying that it does cost too much to assess bilingual doctors and nurses. Finally, one of the last areas in the survey we wanted to find out more about were whether or not they're providing incentives or compensation programs for bilingual skills among their bilingual staff. And what we found were that about 15% of the hospitals actually do have incentives for bilingual ability among their staff. Most of them are using some kind of an add-on to the base pay, and it ranged anywhere from less than $1 per hour to over $20 per hour. A small number are using a one-time payment where staff get either $25 up to $500, and another group of hospitals, about a third, are actually using incentives to compensate bilingual doctors or nurses who serve as interpreters. And those typically would be a payment per encounter or a block of time that they spend interpreting. Again, the range is very large, anywhere from $1 per hour to $1 to $30 per encounter. There were some that were also using reward programs that weren't financial incentives, and these might be a certificate or a special breakfast or an award of sorts. Okay, so I'm going to just talk briefly about some of the interview findings. There were a few key challenges that came out of the interviews that we had. One was resistance from nurses to wearing both the hats of being providing the nursing care they need to provide and also serving as an interpreter. So some nurses don't want to be pulled away from their work and provide care for LEP patients, which they perceive as extra work without compensation. Another challenge we heard was the fear of developing a reputation for having these bilingual skills. They fear having all the patients that speak a specific language if other providers learn that they speak a language. And, given the workload, they don't want to have even more that they may or may not be able to, handle given their current workload. And finally, from the few hospitals we talked to that are documenting information, we heard even from those hospitals that a lot of nurses, it's just too laborious to document the information every hour that you're caring specifically for an LEP patient when there's already so much that they have to do to document that care. And so, even with hospitals that do provide some type of incentive, a lot of them would rather just not get that incentive than have to spend the time documenting. We did hear about a few successes in terms of the hospitals that are doing innovative things in this area. First was the emphasis on the collaboration between language services and nursing. For one of the hospitals we spoke with, language services is actually a part of nursing administration. And language services is one of those types of services that can be anywhere in the hospital. So in this hospital, they really emphasize the importance of being part of nursing and having a close working relationship with nursing, where requests for these lists of bilingual clinicians actually came from nursing and developed into a very successful language proficiency program. And they would work with the nurses at every step to make sure that the programs they're developing are really addressing the concerns that the nurses had. Another lesson we learned was that successful incentives do not necessarily have to be financial. As I mentioned, some of the incentives are so low. One of the hospitals that was using an incentive program across their entire system was only providing $2 an hour. So in their minds, the $2 an hour incentive is not really what is driving the bilingual nurses being interested in the program. And so what they really feel is that they've created for them an incentive where the nurses feel like providing care to the bilingual the LEP patients is really a part of providing nursing and helping their patients. Another hospital in New York had no financial incentive whatsoever, but they had 327 employees go through their training and assessment program, and they really feel like for them, their success is having created this culture where language services is really a part of building priority and improving the quality of their care. And they also indicated that for them, having formal policies about who can and cannot care for LP patients is a big part in terms of having formal mechanisms. Just to wrap up, one of the things we found was that given that nurses are most hospitals are requiring nurses to be trained in how to access language services, this is an opportunity for nurses to be advocates for patients who need language services. Also, we are recommending that hospitals develop explicit policies about providing language services. And there's so many different parts to providing language services, from training nurses and doctors about what they need and how to access language services, to language proficiency assessments, not only for interpreters, but also for nurses and doctors. So developing these types of policies will really help ensure that everyone knows how and when to access language services and really improve the delivery of care to those patients. Also, given that more hospitals are using volunteer interpreters over staff interpreters, and many of them using volunteer interpreters for the exact same way that staff interpreters would be used, it's really important for hospitals to ensure that they are being assessed properly for their language proficiency. Finally, financial incentive programs are very complex from what we've heard and difficult to manage and track, but there are some hospitals out there that are doing it. So we're recommending that there needs to be more information about this area to learn about how to encourage nurses to have their language proficiency assessed and build those resource needs of the hospital. Any questions? Yes.
Did you look at anything related to the congruence between the languages and the healthcare provider's fault?
No, unfortunately, this was not an area that we looked at. But we did, from the hospitals, from the people that we talked to in California, and also from talking to some of the California endowment, they do a lot of research in this language access area. And what they had, they feel strongly that this is not an area where all the doctors who speak a certain language are is matching with the patients who need. So even though we didn't look at that in this area, there's a strong sense that that is not something that's happening where you're necessarily matching the patients. In some areas, I think where a lot of staff are bilingual, where there's a lot of patients, that might be something that's matching, but it's something that would be interesting to look at. Any more questions?
Yes. I just want to make a comment. I think your research is very important because being on the clinical unit with students, many times my students who were from different countries, Russia, Spanish-speaking countries, have been asked to help out because no one spoke the language. And I was wondering, that may be a population you want to, the students who are doing clinical at these hospitals, because they are being asked, and we don't have enough people trained. And it's so important because, case in point, there was one man who thought he was going to have his... something done to his penis. When it wasn't his penis, it was his lung. And he was saying, no, and there was miscommunication. And the student straightened that whole thing out so he could have the right surgery and have the proper information. So, I would be worried too. He had all these ideas. So it's so important. So keep up your good work, really.
Oh, thank you. The thing about the medical residents is an interesting point also. We had someone else in our center who did research on medical residents. And the majority of the medical residents they spoke with are feeling like, why do we need interpreter services? There's a couple, they should learn English is one thing, and we don't have time to call interpreters because it's heavy from our thumb. You're using a dual head, dual telephone handset where you have an interpreter on the other side, and you're trying to speak with a clinician, and it becomes this, triangulation of languages. So it does become complicated. So there's a lot of education that needs to happen among medical residents. And also the issue of pulling a medical resident who may have language skills, but we don't know necessarily, do they have, is it just that they took language classes? Were they trained in another country? And even if they were born in another country, do they know the medical terminology? So there's a lot of patient safety issues in terms of pulling someone out. But realistically speaking, given the hospital resources, that's generally what's happening. Pulling someone out from another field.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you.